Welcome to this session today. This is September 15th, 2013, and we'll be recording the first part of this session, at least, but you don't need to pay any attention to that. I want to recognize this few people in the room as we start here. Actually, I know the name now of everyone in the room at present. But first of all, we want to recognize Professor Walter Mellion here, who's the Asa Griggs professor of art history, who brainstormed this, spearheaded it, and got it all moving. And this is a small part of it. We're just piggybacking off of this. We'll record this, and it will go out over the Rhetoric of Religious Antiquity list, like we regularly do. But next to him are two cohorts. First of all is Ashley Laverock, who has become the new assistant. She had to pick up everything that Elliot Wise had done earlier, and she got. She's obviously a quick study. She has made arrangements for everyone's itinerary and thing. We thank you for that, Ashley. Next to her is Christopher Nygren, the postdoctoral fellow for the year for the Visual Exegesis Mellon Foundation grant, etc. And might as well introduce everyone in the room. In the back is Professor L. Gregory Bloomquist, the professor of Holy Scripture at St. Paul University in Ottawa. And he's actually written two scholarly papers for this event. He has written one on methodology for visual theory and rhetography that he will present tomorrow morning at 9:45 to 11:45 over in the Callaway Center in the Mesos Conference Room. And then he wrote a major paper for the Sawyer Seminar, which will be held at 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock tomorrow afternoon in the Candler School of Theology building here. And then Bart Romaker's is due to arrive very soon.
He's just touched ground.
Yeah, just touched ground. And so he'll be the other one in the Sawyer Seminar room. And then over here to the left is Eric Moore, doctoral student in New Testament Studies here at Emory. Did some real heavy lifting on a book of mine that just recently came out, and just really appreciated all his help. And this is Shirley Hill here, who is joining us today. We're very pleased to have her. She was at the first session last week. And in the front here is John Huss and his wife, Anne. We're so happy to have you here. John Huss is just interested in everything theological, biblical, et cetera, et cetera. So we're just happy to have you here. And Anne, too. They both lead regularly adult studies at Central Presbyterian Church downtown where I myself go. We're so happy to have you here. And then Paul Elbert is here in the front. He's the editor of the Journal of Biblical Research and Pneumatological Studies. Just was doing page proofs on the fifth volume, right? And there. So we welcome all of you here. And a word about procedure. First, oh yes, and there's one more person to introduce. And this is, you can see him here, Professor Roy Giel, who is professor of New Testament at Booth University College in Winnipeg, Canada. He will be here in 2 weeks as a respondent and will lead also one of the sessions. And here's the procedure then, and I'll introduce Professor Harry Meyer in just a moment here. But first, procedure. Oh, first I must say that in addition to sponsorship from the Mellon Visual Exegesis Sawyer Seminar program, this particular session also has additional sponsorship from the Department of Religion, the Graduate Division of Religion, and the Institute for the Liberal Arts, including the evening with food afterwards at our home, and you're all cordially invited. If you want to know a little bit more about directions, why, just ask me, and there'll be plenty of food, etc. So, and this is Mr. Eckhart Richter, who is joining us here. We're so pleased to have you here, Eck. Great. Welcome. The procedure will be, first of all, opening lecture by Professor Harry Meyer, and then we'll have a response through Skype from Professor Roy Geel. He has worked extensively on Colossians and on visual dimensions of in Colossians, and so he's read Professor Meyer's paper, and he will have a number of thoughts about it. So we'll let him respond first. And you want to tell us hello, Roy?
Hello.
Welcome. Yeah, welcome to your session. So happy. So happy you can join us here.
Thank you very much.
Yes. So then we will, after that, have open discussion and dialogue until 6 o'clock. If it extends that long, usually often we're around a table and we really work things over. We're accustomed to doing that, and we'll see how it goes in this session. And then, as I indicated, all are invited afterwards for an evening when we can get together more. But, Harry, we are so pleased to have you here today. And in order to say all I want to about Harry, I need to find another sheet here. You know, that's filled up with his accomplishments, etc. Professor Harry Meyer is Professor of New Testament and Early Christian Studies at Vancouver School of Theology. He got his bachelor from Pacific Lutheran University, his Master of Divinity from Lutheran Theological Seminary in Saskatoon, and in his PhD from Oxford University. In the process, he served two churches in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, in Victoria and Delta, in British Columbia. In 1991 through 93, he was a postdoctoral research fellow at Vancouver School of Theology, then became a full-time faculty member in 1994 and has been there ever since. He was a fellow of the Alexander von Humboldt Stiftung at the University of Heidelberg, 1999, 2000, and then 2004 again. He was the Father Ido Gatto Chair at St. Francis Xavier University in 2003, honorary professor at the University of Exeter in 2009. 2009 and 10, he was awarded, along with Robert Dahm, an Association of Theological Schools Collaborative Research Grant on Disturbing Images, Reading Civic Ideals in Early Judaism and Ancient Christianity Against the Backdrop of Roman Imperial Iconography. And I take it that that has fed significantly into what you're going to talk about today as well. And just in 2012, he was a research fellow at the Max Weber Center for Advanced Cultural and Social Studies at the University of Erfurt in Germany, where he worked on theology of place and self in early Christianity. His first book was The Social Setting of the Ministry as Reflected in the Writings of Hermas, Clement, and Ignatius, appeared in 2002. Then, also in 2002, appeared his Apocalypse Recalled, the Book of Revelation After Christendom. And then a series of very interesting articles. Of course, if I read them all, we'd be here. He wouldn't have any time to talk. But one really interesting title, The Politics of the Silent Bishop, namely Ignatius of Antioch in 2004, and then one called A Sly Civility, Colossians and Empire in the Journal for the Study of New Testament 2005, and also in 2005, Barbarians, Scythians, and Imperial Iconography in the Epistle to the Colossians. There are others that I won't include, but just now but he actually had a copy in his hand and forgot to bring it. He is his book on Picturing Paul in Empire, Imperial Image, Text, and Persuasion in Colossians, Ephesians, and the Pastoral Epistles, that is officially out like next month or so with Bloomsbury T&T Clark, but he had a copy in hand. And I've had a chance to look in it, and it is stunning. And he will be bringing insights from much of that work here today.
Yes.
So we welcome you, Harry. So glad you're here.
Right.
Please.
Thank you so much.
Go ahead.
Thank you so much. So, Roy, I'm going to put you behind the curtain for a moment here.
Yeah, I muted him, so we
can. If he coughs or anything, he can read my lips.
Yeah, yeah. And then when you want to hear him, just push that little mute button off.
And okay. And if I don't want to hear him,
so Roy, you can cough if you wish or whatever.
Okay. All right.
clear your throat.
Well, I'm so pleased to be invited to speak here and to present tomorrow as well. I'm very grateful to you, Professor Mallion, also for making this a possibility. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to give a bit of a PowerPoint presentation to orient the paper more generally and to draw out some of the high points of the paper, and I hope that will then give us enough to talk about, whether you've read the paper closely or not. I think will give us enough material to go with. So what I'm going to do to start with is I'm going to introduce some of the aspects of Paul and Empire research and show my disagreements with recent Paul and Empire research. So talk about that kind of, because it sort of has a political agenda, I think, that kind of flies under the radar. And then I want to talk about rhetoric and then introduce a concept that I developed called the imperial situation. And after I've done describing that, what I hope to show is how the Epistle to the Colossians represents what I call an imperial situation. And I hope to illustrate that by showing how both how the texts of the letter to the Colossians have significant parallels with images of that were current with the letter in the Roman Empire. And I hope that then will leave us enough food for thought and enough food for discussion. So I expect that will take me about 40 minutes. About that. So I'll come back to this image in a moment. Firstly, for those of you who may not be at home in the New Testament or and so on, this is the geographical area we're talking to, the letter to the Colossians, which is, as you probably know, the letter to the Colossians attributed to Paul, debate about that, that aspect is not going to be affecting the discussion today. So I'll just talk about Paul, and we'll just assume that either it was Paul or it was somebody who was a follower of Paul. But I'll just talk about as Paul, okay? So Paul's letter to the Colossians, also addressed to believers in Laodicea, just down the road here, and also believers in Hierapolis, in an area here called the Lycus Valley, which runs north-south in the Menander Valley, which runs east-west, on an important Roman road that also significantly is a road that connects up here with the west coast, especially through Magnesia, a little bit north through Pergamon, Smyrna, and then Pergamon. This is a highly, highly expanded map here, so these distances are much closer than you might otherwise be led to believe by this image. And the other very important aspect here that I'll be talking about is the city of Aphrodisias, which you can't see a road here, but there is a road that goes around this mountain here. If you've ever driven through the area, you know that it's impossible to get from here to here without going around this mountain, which takes a very long time if you want to go see Hierapolis and so on. But Aphrodisias was a very important site because it was the site of an imperial temple. An imperial temple that was begun at the around 30 in the first century and completed under the Emperor Nero in the 60s. So what's interesting about that is that the temple to the emperors, or the Sebastion at Aphrodisias was being built probably at the time that the letter to the Colossians was written, whether one takes it as being written directly by Paul or by a Pauline follower. So I'll be giving a lot of attention then to iconography in Aphrodisias. So this is our basic our basic lay of the land. Also interesting here, just from the perspective of if Colossians was not written by Paul, What's interesting is that the letter to the Colossians has enormous numbers of parallels with the letter to the Ephesians, also, which is a letter, a contested letter. Not everybody thinks that Paul wrote the letter to the Ephesians. What's very interesting about these roads here is that these roads are important trade routes, and outside of the letters of Colossians and Ephesians, we have a lot of treaties going on between these various cities who were rivals with each other, and suggest that there was a lot of inter-civic, inter-urban contact, which might explain why Colossians and Ephesians are so closely related to each other. All right, onward. Okay, so we're talking about Paul and the Roman Empire here, and especially when we're talking about imperial situation, then this then places us in a larger disciplinary field that whose focus has been on empire and imperial studies. Not only in New Testament studies, but in a variety of studies, English literature, most of the humanities, there has been increasing attention to aspects of empire, colonialism, post-colonialism, and so on. And one of the more popular books is by Michael Hart and Antonio Negri, 2000, so this is just before 9/11, which I hope to show is going to be significant in just a moment. Empires materializing before our very eyes over the past several decades as colonial regimes are overthrown and then precipitously after the Soviet barriers to the capitalist world market finally collapsed, we have witnessed an irresistible and irreversible globalization of economic and cultural exchanges, right? So the idea then of a global market now becomes the mise-en-scene, if you will, for discussing empire. So this is an empire without emperors, the empire of capital. And this has had a very important effect on New Testament scholars. For example, Fernando Segovia, in an essay called Biblical Criticism and Postcolonial Studies in R.S. Shugitaraja's The Postcolonial Bible, Cuban, teaches at Vanderbilt, said, critical Bible study is always conducted in the reality of empire and omnipresent, inescapable, and overwhelming socio-political reality. So that for Segovia, right, critical biblical studies, right, always must pay attention to politics and expressly must pay attention to global imperial politics. And here I think Hart and Negri's notion of empire as a social organization brought about by the spread of global capital would be sort of the preeminent lens. So if you're not doing that, right, then you're not doing critical biblical studies. So this is a very, ironically, a sort of an imperial description of what biblical study should be. But Professor Segovia is not one to take anything lying down, if you've ever met him. All right. So in the late 90s, especially under the leadership of Richard Horsley, who's at Boston University, he published a book of essays, which were collections of presentations from a group at the Society of Biblical Literature called the Paul and Empire Group, or Paul and Politics Group, became a kind of a Paul and Empire Group, but Paul and Politics Group. And he collected a number of essays together and writes, right on page one, Christianity was the product of empire. Christianity was the product of empire. Now, causation historically, for any of us who are historians, causation historically is always a bit of a touchy thing, right? Exactly what is salient in the causation of historical events, right? What causes A, what causes B, what causes C is always extraordinarily complex. But Richard Horsley has distilled this down into a very simple subject predicate here. Christianity was the product of empire. So that's a very, very bold statement, a statement that I hope to contest. One might say it was a byproduct of empire. One might say that it was inextricably entangled in empire. There are problems here with this sentence, both with the term Christianity, which is a very, very large term, and also with the term empire, which is also a very, very large abstraction, right? But I think that what Richard Horsley is trying to do is that he's trying to affirm what Segovia's point is that critical biblical study always must take place in the context of empire, right? And that's, and many of the essays in Paul and Empire are expressly attempting to show how Paul's letters, and here especially the earlier letters, the what I'll call the uncontested letters, the letters that everybody agrees Paul wrote, have as their major backdrop the Roman Empire, and that Paul was always engaging the Roman Empire at one level or another, and not just kind of subconsciously, but absolutely consciously as well. So, I like the flames here. So, according to Horsley and company, it's a great volume. So it sounds like I'm panning the volume. In fact, I'm not. It actually is a great volume of essays in there. Paul's gospel was political in orientation. I'd say it was motivated by politics, right? So its orientation was consciously, directly political. It exposed the violence of Roman rule, so that Paul's gospel was cognizant of violence and addressed violence directly as a means of opposing Roman imperial violence, the violence of the state. It was opposed to the imperial cult. N.T. Wright, whose essay in this volume is called Caesar's Empire and Paul's Gospel, I think that's the title of it, takes up a reading of Philippians and argues that the imperial cult, the cult to the emperor, the worship of the emperor, was, he says, the glue that held the Roman Empire together. The glue that, like, the glue, not a glue, but the glue that held the Roman Empire together, which I think is nonsense. But we'll talk about that. Suffered persecution for his anti-Roman stance. That is to say, Paul was always in jail because he opposed the Roman Empire. We have other scholars like Neil Elliott, who also appears in the Paul and Empire volume, who argues that even when Paul doesn't directly name the Roman Empire, for example, when he talks about the Jewish law in Romans, he in fact means the Roman Empire, but that Paul was using what he calls a hidden transcript, that is to say, that he was speaking in coded, veiled language so as to fly under the radar of Roman imperial surveillance. So we must imagine then a Roman imperial world in which we have Roman imperial agents around the corner listening in, intercepting the mail, trying to see whether you're talking against the empire or not. So therefore, even where the Roman Empire is not mentioned, Paul is talking about the Roman Empire. So historiographically, right, if you argue that way, you can argue just about anything. Just about anything can be true once you appeal to those kinds of arguments. So suffered persecution for his anti-Roman stance, and assaulted Rome with a counter-imperial worship of God in Christ. In other words, that the worship of Jesus as Christ, the worship of Jesus as God's emissary, as a plan to unite Jews and Gentiles, was motivated as an anti-imperial gospel, right? So Paul's eschatology, Paul's apocalyptic, and so on and so forth, had in its crosshairs the Roman Empire, and expressly Roman imperial violence, and the Roman emperor. And so the worship of Jesus, then, is in direct opposition to the worship of the emperor as a son of God, or as a divine figure. Now, this is meant to be a funny cartoon, the Pax Romana equals the Pax Americana, and here you can see a representation of George W. Bush, dressed up as Nero, playing the fiddle while Rome is burning, And there, right there, I can't quite make out those words right anymore. But the reason why I have this cartoon here is not to cast aspersions on President Bush, but rather to show that the Paul and Empire scholarship has been conducted largely against a backdrop of what Hart and Negri talk about is the global expansion of capital. And when we think about the global expansion of capital, well, the first thing that we should think about is the United States, Wall Street, and so on. And so much of the Paul and Empire work is has been done by a group of scholars who also, not surprisingly, are against an idea of American imperialism, or what they in other writings want to describe as a form of American imperialism. And Richard Horsley states that after, firstly, after the first Gulf War of 1993, and then the invasion of Afghanistan, that in fact, he says, that interest in the Paul and Politics group mushroomed, right? So that there was an enormous amount of interest and attention given to this. And if you just type in Paul and Empire in a Google search, you'll discover thousands upon thousands of references. So empire has become a kind of a commodity, especially when it comes to selling books on the New Testament and New Testament studies. So my own work has been, to a degree, affected by all of this. My own work began with my book on the Book of Revelation, Apocalypse Recalled, the Book of Revelation After Christendom, in which I argued that John's Apocalypse, which has often been interpreted as a kind of a book of comfort for people who are suffering persecution, that the Apocalypse was not written as a book of comfort, but rather was written as a book of profound prophetic challenge against early Christ followers whom John believed were capitulating to Roman imperial economic interests and pursuits. And that the whole of Revelation, from start to finish, is an attempt to awaken faithful discipleship as a means of resistance to Roman imperial expressly economic realities. When I wrote Apocalypse Recalled, I was already becoming very cognizant of Roman imperial imagery, Roman imperial vocabulary in the Book of Revelation. John represents Jesus often with vocabulary that's being used to celebrate, worship, magnify the Roman emperor, and so we're already in a world of the appropriation of Roman imperial vocabulary, Roman imperial imagery, but with a view to exposing the Roman Empire and its economic oppression of the world, of the empire, and replacing it with proper devotion to Jesus, the slain lamb, who is the victim of the violence of the Roman Empire. Well, when I wrote that book in 2002, everything really seemed very simple to me. And then I started investigating about the Roman Empire more and about the imperial cult more, and I realized that things were not quite so simple. In fact, that the worship of the Roman emperor was a very complicated phenomenon. It was not always the same everywhere. It was not everywhere. It was very much developing through the course of the first century, and that when we speak of the worship of the Roman emperor, we must then pay attention to specific locations, specific language, specific motivations, and so on. And for those who are interested in following up more about that, Stephen Friesen wrote a book called Reading Revelation in the Ruins that came out in the same year as my book, and I must say his book is far, far superior to my book, precisely because it is so nuanced in that it takes up the worship of the emperor in Asia Minor, in Smyrna, Ephesus, Laodicea, Pergamon, and charts how imperial temples were built, who supported them, who patronized them, what they got out of patronizing them, and so on and so forth. So it's a much thicker and far more satisfying description, though my book might be better because I use some interesting literary devices, including autobiography. But I'll leave it to you to decide whether my autobiography is interesting enough to read or not. All right, it's Pax Romana. Now, in my book, and in the essay that you hopefully will have read or have access to, I talk about rhetoric and persuasion, and I talk about I talk about or introduce the idea of the rhetorical situation, and then criticize that and reformulate the rhetorical situation into what I describe as the imperial situation. So what is the rhetorical situation? What do we mean when we speak of the rhetorical situation? Well, the rhetorical situation is a phrase that was coined by Larry Bitzer.
I think you mean Lloyd.
Lloyd Bitzer, in his essay, The Rhetorical Situation, published in 1968. And on page 3, he describes the rhetorical situation as, quote, a complex of persons, events, objects, and relations presenting an actual or potential exigence which can be completely or partially removed if discourse introduced into the situation can so constrain human decision or action as to bring about the significant modification of the exigence. All right, so this is a fairly positivist definition of what the rhetorical situation is. Why is it positivist? Because he says, an actual or potential exigence which can be completely or partially removed if discourse, right, is so followed to constrain human decision or action and so on and so forth. So you have an empirical situation, right? You see a piece of rhetoric. That piece of rhetoric then is a response to that situation, and that rhetoric then is designed to persuade you to change your behaviors in one way or another so as to bring about another situation, all right? So there's an empirical location here. Now, one of the things, this is in 1968, so this is before postmodernity. This is when people in the 60s, at least Lloyd Bitzer is very confident that he can tell us what historical events are and so on and so forth, right? But what this definition of rhetorical situation masks or doesn't pay enough attention to is not just that rhetoric is a response to an actual or potential exigence, but that rhetoric creates a potential or actual exigence. In other words, texts not only sort of reflect reality, so you can read through texts like windows to see what's going on behind them. Texts create realities. They invite people into lived reality to imagine the world in a particular way, right? So texts create rhetorical situations as much as they are responses to rhetorical situations. So I would want to see a much more interactionist and more hermeneutically sophisticated way of thinking about the rhetorical situation than Bitzer here allows. And those who have critiqued Bitzer subsequently have come to the same basic kinds of conclusions and are interested then in the social construction of rhetoric as much as they're interested in how rhetoric responds to situations. And so what I did then is I redeveloped Bitzer's phrase, and I changed the phrase into what I call imperial situation. And I'm going to now walk you through what I mean by imperial situation, which I hope preserves this interactionist, more hermeneutically sophisticated account that I claim to be championing. All right? So An Imperial Situation describes the use of evocative and vivid imagery drawn from imperial and or civic discourse to represent listeners as participants in, beneficiaries of, or living the consequences arising from the reign of God and our Christ represented as a universal rule. So I'm developing the phrase rhetorical or imperial situation expressly with reference to the Colossians, but I think that one can do this generally with Paul's letters for reasons that I hope to show in a moment. So the use of evocative, right, to represent, so representational here means that creation of. So representation both reflects and also creates, right? Okay. Second part. With the help of imperial language and imagery, listeners are made, or I might say persuaded, to visualize themselves as actors on an imperial-looking stage and in an imperial-looking drama whose circumstances and outcomes could be witnessed and were experienced ubiquitously everywhere in imperial iconography, whether that took the form of coins, monuments, household furniture, frescoes, games, civic liturgies, processions, placards, mimes, or any other of the multiple forms of visual media whose aim was to convince audiences of or offered them avenues to champion the benefits of Roman rule and the divinely sanctioned position of Rome and its allies as rulers of the world. So there you know that I'm a German, because that's a very long sentence. All right? Imperial language and imagery made to visualize a self as an actor, right? So here I'm interested in kind of a social psychological understanding, right? That people through language are encouraged to represent themselves and see themselves as actors on a social stage and participants in a social drama. And this is how I think that Paul's letters are inviting their audiences to conceive themselves as actors on a stage, participants in a theater with God as their observer, in which they're invited to pursue fictive roles, to imagine themselves in new and dramatic ways so as to act in particular ways to bring about particular outcomes, right? And that the use of imperial language is important language because it's very evocative. It's very evocative language and it's very universalizing language. So imagery, imperial vocabulary to describe the benefits of imperial Roman rule, the social goods that come about through it, what the gods have done with the emperor and the Roman Empire, these furnish a kind of a Roman imperial backdrop and a resource for using evocative language to persuade people that they are actors on a stage. Now, the stage that they're acting on is not Caesar's empire, but the stage that they're acting on is the world as recreated through the death and the resurrection of Jesus. This would be Paul's theology, a world recreated through the death and the resurrection of Jesus, which is being made new, and in the earlier Pauline letters, which is being ever more fully realized and will be completed with the coming of Jesus again, or in the later Pauline letters, whose fullness already is manifested now and will still be most fully represented in the parousia, the second coming of Jesus, though that has more of an abstract or not a determinate meaning in the later letters. All right. Okay. Imperial image and imagery represented a shared vocabulary and mindset both writer and audience relied upon to communicate and understand religious claims of emergent Pauline Christianity. A shared vocabulary and mindset. So, in the paper, I talk about some of the progymnasmata, or rhetorical handbooks, that are roughly contemporary with the early period of the New Testament, in which these are exercise books, and they are designed for the instruction of rhetoric. And in one of in each of these rhetorical handbooks, there is a section dedicated to the use of vivid speech, ekphrasis. Ekphrasis is a description of a person, an event, a topic in which one describes it vividly. And work on ekphrasis has also focused on the work of other rhetoricians, especially the rhetorician Quintilian, another first century rhetorician, who drew out the psychology of what's entailed in ekphrasis more fully. And Roy Geel is going to serve you up a lovely essay in which he's going to be exploring the psychological mechanisms of ekphrasis more fully in a fortnight, you say?
Yes.
Right. Okay. But I'm not going to steal his thunder, but I am going to say here, to whet your appetite, if you will, that what's critical, according to Quintilian, in the use of vivid speech in order to persuade is that that vivid speech, vivid description does not depart too widely from what people experience, from what people see, right? So that the effective rhetorician, right, will show his unity or her unity with their audience by assuring that the template of experiences does not depart too widely. So what ekphrasis does is it creates vivid language, it prompts memories in ancient psychology. These ancient memories then trigger emotions, so that speaker and listener then share an emotive world, a set of emotional responses, reactions, and thereby persuasion happens. Well, you can probably see how important this would be for the kind of case that I'm developing here, right? Especially when I say imperial language and imagery represent a shared vocabulary and mindset. Shared vocabulary and mindset. Now, some people will speak of things like the period I, right? Barandaxel, however you pronounce his name. Others, like Roy J, speaks of a term like the scopic regime, right? Here, possibly drawing on some Lacanian analysis as well. So differing scholars have talked about this mindset in differing ways. I like to think about the period. Here I'm just wanting to talk about a kind of a Pauline mindset. And this Pauline mindset centers on fairly recurring vocabulary that represents Jesus in imperial language, Jesus enjoying a victory, Jesus bringing about a worldwide unity of humankind, and so on. And that Paul uses imperial language so as to make universal claims that are recognizable, that are understandable, and that prompt certain emotional responses, positive emotional responses. So Paul is being, I think sometimes consciously, probably as simply a member of his culture, unconsciously, right, using evocative imperial language so as to make the universal claims of his gospel. Very interesting about Paul is that his letters are peppered with imperial-sounding words. Ecclesia, political term, gospel, another imperial term, victory, O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? A kind of an acclamation that is a very imperial-sounding acclamation that one might have heard in a victory parade, and so on. All right. So here we go. Its usage fulfilled a precondition of ekphrastic or vivid speech that the ideal speaker was to place a picture of the declaimed upon topic before a listener's eyes, and that that picture draw upon shared experience in order to achieve its full effect. That's just what I just said. All right? These slides will be mounted, yeah? Mm-hmm. Absolutely good. Okay. All right. So, what I want to do now is just walk us through some texts, point out some instances of imperial vocabulary, political and civic vocabulary, look at some images, then show how the images also draw on themes and affirmations that we can find in the text, either expressly or by implication. Now, I want to be really, really clear here that I am not saying that Christianity was the product of the Roman Empire. I think that what emerged as Christianity, which is to say that emergent Christianity, was the product of a confluence of forces, a very, very complex series of forces that in varying and different ways affected the rise of that movement differently. So one would be the Hebrew Bible. Another one would be religious experience of the divine. Another one would be sort of practicalities, strategic practicalities for the survival of the movement. In other words, I don't want to reduce what I'm talking about here to a single cause, right? So I'm not really interested in a kind of a positivistic model of history where A causes B causes C. History is always an entanglement, and we are as entangled in history as the sources that we read and try to interpret. So what I'm doing now really is I'm just wanting to tease out one variable, an important variable, a variable that I think is not often enough recognized, especially in Colossian scholarship, but not the only one. So what I've done here is, this is from my Accordance Bible, so you'll always know which verse you're in as well as what letter you're in here, is that what I've done is I put, which is actually not so easy to see on the screen, I should have placed it in bold letters, but I put in italics phrases and terms that seem to have an imperial resonance, so seem to, arguably, have an imperial resonance. I'm arguing they have an imperial resonance, okay? So Paul, an apostle of Christ Jesus by the will of God, and Timothy, our brother, to the saints and faithful brethren, this is the RSV, so brothers and sisters in Christ at Colossae, grace to you in peace from God our Father. We always thank God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, when we pray for you, because we have heard of your faith in Christ Jesus and of the love you have for all the saints, because of the hope laid up for you in heaven. And here I have italicized, of this you have heard before in the word of the truth, the gospel, which has come to you, as indeed in the whole world it is bearing fruit and growing, so among yourselves from the day you heard and understood the grace of God in truth, as you learned it from Epaphras, our beloved servant. He is a faithful minister of Christ on our behalf and has made known to us your love in the Spirit. So here, the whole world bearing fruit and growing. Now that is very evocative language, that is universal language, that is kind of totalizing language. And I want to suggest to you that that language is there in its evocative form to persuade the listeners that this gospel is indeed universal as it is. And one of the ways that this language is so evocative is because of the lived visual experience of listeners on the streets of Colossae, Laodicea, in Hierapolis. Now, in order to make these kinds of claims, I have to have a fairly wide reach, because of course, turn my lights down. Very good, okay. I have to have a fairly wide reach. Some of you may recognize this as part of the Areopagus, the altar of peace in Rome, erected by Augustus as part of his grave project to house his family, and this is a part of the monument called the Great Vegetative Frieze. The Great Vegetative Frieze, which runs around the exterior bottom of the monument, and what's significant about this is the notion of fertility, abundance, growth, nature in harmony, Augustus's contemporary poets were celebrating the rise of Augustus as a period of time when the world was bringing forth its plenty. And when we look a little bit later at panegyrists, say, contemporary with Nero, we discover the same kinds of themes going on. Okay? So there is here an equation of the rise of the emperor, the rule of the emperor, with fertility, growth, abundance. Here, now this is much closer to Colossae in space and time, to the letter of the Colossians, to space and time. This is now from the Sebastion at Aphrodisias, which I introduced at the start of the talk, right? Just around the mountain from a big mountain, but nevertheless, just around the mountain from Colossae. And here we have a Roman imperial prince, heroic nude, a bound captive boy, a barbarian. We know that because he's wearing trousers, right? And holding a globe, right? The whole world. So the globe in Roman imperial iconography, they're often holding these balls, whether on coins or monuments, right? These balls that they're holding are representative of the globe. They're representative of the imperium, the authority of the emperor to govern the world. The world being understood as the Roman Empire, or the extent of the geographical control of the Roman imperium. So there is in this representation always a kind of a universal, worldwide political acclamation, and it's designed to be evocative, right? It's designed to give you a sense that this is a kind of a divinely appointed rule here that has been brought about. A rule through military might, hence the bound barbarian. And here we have arms to the left here. All right. So, a gospel that has been expanding through the whole world and bearing fruit has some interesting parallels in Roman imperial iconography. All right. Colossians 1:13 and following. This is also known as a hymn. 15 to 20 is often identified as a Christ hymn. He has delivered us from the dominion, and here I do underline them, the dominion of darkness, and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for in him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. So head of the body here is a political slogan, the body politic. We have this phrase in the English language, comes from ancient usage. Aristotle and so on likened the rightly governing state to a properly functioned body. He is the head of the body, the church. Nero was instructed by Seneca to stay morally upright, because the health of the emperor as the head of the empire then means that the rest of his body will be healthy as well. So it's a very interesting direct political application of the notion of the emperor as head of a healthy body. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on heaven or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. So, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, which is a very, very high Christological affirmation, one of the highest Christological affirmations that we find in the New Testament. What's intriguing there is not that the emperor was believed to have the fullness of God dwelling in him, but the emperor was believed to have invested in him the full authority of Jupiter, the full authority of God to administer the empire on the gods' behalf. And this is a representation that starts already in the Julio-Claudian period, continues through the reigns of the Flavians, Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian, and then especially becomes increasingly important under the reigns of Trajan and Hadrian. Right? So we have this kind of imperial monotheism that is developing at the very same time that we have what Tom Wright calls a Christological monotheism developing in Pauline theology. And through him to reconcile. This word reconcile is a very, very interesting word. In its form, it appears only once in Greek, and here in the letter to the Colossians. But the reconciliation language is also strongly political language. It's the language of diplomacy. To make people who are enemies into friends, to make people who are estranged from one another to lay down their arms and to come to peace with each other. And that's precisely what we find now being developed in the hymn, which I think is quite fascinating. Through him to reconcile to him all things, whether on heaven and earth, making peace by the blood of his cross. Now, that term, making peace, ereno poieng, to make peace, erene, is another important political term. That was associated with the victory of the Roman Empire and the emperor. Here, irene, or peace, meaning pacification. Pacification through violence. When the Romans spoke of peace, the Pax Romana, they meant the Roman pacification of the world. Right? Ideally done through diplomacy, but if diplomacy didn't work, then through the army. And here, following the making peace, we have by the blood of his cross, right? Namely, not by the execution of enemies, but rather through his own execution. And this is now where, and often I say this, I'm not saying this just because I'm a Lutheran, this is where Paul's theology becomes kind of exciting from this aspect of an imperial lens, right? Because it's through a theology of the cross, right, rather than a theology of victory through violence exacted on others, that Paul, and here in Colossians, finds the true source of the reach of God across all nations, right? So it's not an empire of force, it rather becomes an empire of love. An empire of love. And you, who once were estranged and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death. Now, in the Roman imperial imagination, those who are estranged and hostile in mind and doing evil deeds, these are the ones who, in the Roman imperial imagination, are the ones who are conquered. Right? And they're brought into a realm of virtue. This is Roman imperial propaganda. And God has appointed the Romans, because they are the most virtuous folks on the block, to spread divinely pleasing virtue and morals to the rest of the world, namely those who are estranged and hostile in mind, to bring concord where there was estrangement. Here, the trope is obviously reversed, right? It's not by conquering and pacifying again, it's rather through his death that there is a victory and reconciliation, right? In order to present you holy and blameless and irreproachable before him, provided that you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which has been preached to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister. Again, notice the universal quality of this gospel, right? Faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting. Those words, stable, steadfast, not shifting, these are architectural terms. And this architectural language is at home in political treatises of the period that describe what the rightly functioning state is like. It is stable, it is steadfast, it doesn't shift, it's like a well-constructed building, Margaret Mitchell, in her book on 1 Corinthians and Reconciliation, gives a lot of attention to this use of architectural language in 1 Corinthians, especially in chapters 1 to 4. But here, it's appearing in Colossians, and it is as political here as it is there. All right? How am I doing here for time?
You have 5 o'clock up there.
5, yes. Okay, what time did I start? I'm coming. All right, I'll be coming to the end here. And so here we have some Roman imperial coins, right? So, yes, we can deal with monuments, and we can deal with aphrodisias and the Areopagus and so on and so forth, but what did that actually have to do with anybody living in Colossae or Laodicea? Well, these iconographical themes were widespread through the use of coinage, and emperors gave a lot of attention to what appeared on these coins. And my argument about these coins is that we should imagine these as icons on a computer screen, right, rather than just kind of things that just refer to themselves. This is like a little thing that you click on, and it tells a whole story. A whole narrative unfolds. So these are metonyms. Metonyms of larger narratives. Okay? And here we have Victory, the imperial goddess with a crown, right? Rewarding the emperor for his military successes with the inscription Pacti Augusti, the Peace of Augustus, the Augustan Peace. Here is a very visual token of an imperial claim that was spread everywhere across the Roman Empire. In a low denomination, and especially when we come up to the reigns of Vespasian and Titus, now we have the lowest denominations that are increasingly receiving this kind of careful attention, because it's these low denominations, right, pennies, that are the ones that are having the widest currency. Very, very important. Here again we have the globe, Victory, Victoria Auguste. And the globe, of course, refers to the Augustan victory over the whole world. I'm going through these images a little bit quickly here. Yes, go ahead.
What period is the previous coin from?
Period.
The previous one.
This one? Yeah. This coin is from the reign of Augustus. Right. Okay. But we have the same coins that are reissued through the whole Julio-Claudian period, right up to Nero and beyond. All right. Interestingly, in Laodicea, which I don't have a picture of this here, but in Laodicea, right, under the reign of Nero, right, we have a coin of Zeus on one side of the coin, and on the other side we have an inscription of him as son of God. Right, so here we have an intriguing representation of the emperor as divine, connected up with Zeus. This is what I mean when I speak of the emperor as the regent of the gods. Right. Now, I'm not trying to say that whoever wrote Colossians was just cribbing from Roman imperial coins and language. The point that I'm trying to make is that rather the writer used this language to celebrate divine claims about Jesus in an evocative way so as to persuade listeners of the claims that were being made. That's the point I'm trying to make here. All right. The so-called Gemma Augustea, which is a luxury item, so this is not an item that you would have found every day, only one of these existed. But one of the interesting things about Roman imperial iconography is how this iconography became household furniture and rings, gems. People kind of literally wore this. Paul Zanker talks about the internalization, the processes of internalization of imperial iconography. So imagine having a table in your home with Roman imperial victories holding it up, right? Kind of odd, but this is the sort of thing you find. Ceilings with victories, wallpaper with victories, or frescoes with victories, and so on. And here we have a luxury item, the Gemma Augustea, but which is a wonderful representation of what is entailed through the idea of Roman pacification. So we have two registers, an upper register and a lower register. In the lower register, we have a Roman, the Roman army is erecting a trophy, right? And so they've been successful in battle, and they have vanquished enemies. Enemies who are in a state of lack of civilization. How do we know that they lack civilization? We know that they lack civilization because they have unbound hair. They wear trousers, right? And the woman here has unbound hair as well. That's why he can pull her hair, all right? So what's happening here is that those estranged and hostile in mind are being reconciled. This is what would have been understood as reconciliation in the Roman imperial imagination. Pacification. Reconciliation. All right. Interesting with the helmets here of the Roman legionaries is that these helmets are from different parts of the Roman Empire. So this is a kind of a pastiche of the legionaries that are across the empire. Okay? In the upper register, we have Augustus is here, Tiberius is here, a prince, Germanicus, is here. All right? Augustus is represented enthroned as Jupiter. Beside him is Roma, the patron goddess of Rome. Okay. Above him is a star with Capricorn on it, which is the zodiac sign under which Augustus was born. Okay. Behind him, debate about this, but perhaps Italia or the Senate crowning Augustus with victory. Neptune, associated with Augustus's family and divine parentage. Tellus, the goddess of fertility, holding a cornucopia. Remember this notion of flourishing, growing, a gospel growing in all the world. The cornucopia regularly appears in the iconography. A child down here, Augustus, one of the things that Augustus did was that he lifted tax, he offered tax exemptions for people who had more children, and so on. So again, another token of fertility. The eagle, symbol of Jupiter, just in case you didn't quite get it, right? There's the eagle, the symbol of Jupiter. And here we have Tiberius, behind him is Victory. You can see a bit of her wing there. And below here is armature. They're all stepping on enemies' armature, presumably these people's armature down here. Okay. Now, what's interesting in this picture from the perspective of the letter to the Colossians is the notion both of victory and of enthronement. Victory and enthronement. One of the ways that Colossians differs in theology from, say, Paul's letter to the Romans is that whereas in Romans enthronement is future, also in 1 Corinthians enthronement is future, in Colossians and Ephesians enthronement is now. Right? So Christ has died, he has been raised, and he has ascended and is now enthroned with God in heaven. And the followers of Christ are similarly enthroned with him. Because he is the head, right? And where the head goes, the body goes, right? So if you're the body of Christ and Christ is the head, then when Christ is enthroned beside the Father, so you are enthroned beside the Father as well, above all principalities and powers. So the language of enthronement here, right, is very evocative and has a lot of other evocations in the Hebrew Bible and so on, but importantly, also, and I want to say, underscore that, also has an imperial evocation. An imperial evocation. All right. And this is the last one. Perhaps one of the most, one of the, actually I have two more, but maybe I'll just stop with this one, and because I'm sure you're all bursting with questions by now. Colossians 2.15, intriguingly here, this is the RSV translation, he disarmed the principalities and powers and made a public example of them, triumphing over them in them, in him. It's a very traditional interpretation, translation one they usually find. But Roy Yates, in an essay in New Testament Studies in 91, suggests a different translation, which in fact actually captures what is going on in the rest of Colossians. And the Greek grammar is equally patient of this translation. And so I find this translation actually much closer to what the imperial situation of Colossians is creating for its listeners, right? Having stripped himself, or having been stripped, he made a bold public exposure of the principalities and rulers, triumphing over them in it, namely in the cross. So, this would be a traditional Roman triumphal theology, right? You vanquish the enemies and then you parade them. Here, you have an inversion of that ideology. Here, Christ is crucified, and in being crucified, he displays who the principalities and powers are, which probably include cosmic powers, but probably also includes Roman imperial powers who crucified him, right? And then triumphs over them through the cross. Here we have the first representation. He disarmed the principalities and powers. This would be the traditional theology of pacification. This is the great, this is the fantastic victory relief in the Ephesus Museum in Vienna, celebrating the victory of the Antonine emperors. It used to be on an imperial temple in Ephesus, and then the Ephesus has been excavated by the Austrians now for a long time, a century at least, and they took the whole bit of it back to Vienna, and they created this fantastic display of it. And this is just one bit of the relief. And here we have a Roman imperial soldier, legionary, right, slaying, disarming enemies. If we had time and more space, what I could show you here is that you notice the serenity of the Roman imperial soldier, right? When we do have most of these sculptures have been destroyed, but when they do survive, we see these people in dramatic representations of agony, fear, terror. So we have the sobriety, the serenity, the self-control of the Roman soldier pitted against the lack of control, the lack of sobriety of the vanquished. Right? And the idea is that where he is, they are going to be. After the Roman Empire is done with them, they're all going to look sober and self-controlled just like he is. Interesting, when we look at Paul and he talks about the rule of Christ, he often juxtaposes a life of immoderation, drunkenness, levity, emotion, right? Really sort of out of control emotion, with a new life of sobriety, modesty, self-control, right? So we have a kind of an imperial transformation unfolding. Colossians presents its listeners as inhabiting this world of transformation, and in doing so, places its listeners in an imperial situation. Here we have The second way of thinking about this text from 215, he made old exposure triumphing over them. Here, and this also picks up on what we find in 2 Corinthians, where Paul talks about himself as being a captive in the triumphal procession of Christ. Now, when we think of captive in a triumphal procession, right, we're not thinking about people throwing flowers about and skipping about with garlands and so on. This is the image that would be foremost in mind. That is what it means to be a captive in the triumphal procession, to be humiliated. New Testament exegetes have been kind of uncomfortable with that whole image, right? So they've tried to interpret it in a variety of different ways. But in 2 Corinthians especially, Paul is in a competition with people who are boastful, right? And who are wanting to say that they have more power than Paul and so on and so forth. So what Paul does, a clever rhetor that he is he says, well, if I'm going to boast in anything, let me boast about my weakness. So we're going to talk about being in a triumphal procession. Yeah, well, that's where I am, right there. Humiliated. Right? I can be worse than you can. Let me show you how. It's extraordinarily evocative, powerful, unexpected. I'm sure, and certainly it calls me up short, so I have to be careful by my own eisegetical sympathies here. But it is really, really remarkable. Okay, I think I should stop here. I could talk about the barbarians and the Scythians, but I don't. I do want to give you some opportunity to, and especially Roy, to respond to what I've been talking about here. So. Roy Big, yes?
Yes, can you make him big, bigger?
Mm-hmm. Do you know how to do that?
No, not on this way. He's fine.
Okay, there he is. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, Roy. Yeah, we would welcome your response here, and then after your response a bit, then we'll open it up here for the discussion.
All right, well, Harry, thanks very much for your presentation. Appreciate it very much. Among the many things that I particularly appreciate is how you work to obtain a balance in the discussions regarding Paul and the Roman Empire and its power and influence and Paul's interactions with what you're calling, I think very helpfully, imperial situation. I think that's very helpful to use that kind of terminology. Another and actually related point is that you show that rhetorical situations are not only addressed, they are also created. I think this is very important. And that Paul used empire language or imperial situations to do this, to create situations. And also your other terminology, I'm not sure you actually used it in your presentation just now, but the terminology in your paper of cultural hybridity is very helpful here in all of this, and I thank you for it. And I also appreciate how you, as you say, draw image and text together to make things really clear. So thank you very much. I thought what I would do would be to ask two questions, and here's the first one. It's maybe a bit long, but here's my first question. Do you think that Paul in Colossians, or perhaps I should say Paul or Colossians, are going after or promoting the sacred? And by sacred, I mean something, is it getting at something of what Vernon calls sacred texture? That Colossians is not aimed directly against subversion of the Roman sacred, even if that happens. But that Paul's or Colossians' primary aim is to promote wisdom and the sacred as a Christ believer for the good of Christ believers. I think you say things like this, but in the paper. But I wonder if you can flesh it out a little bit more. Is Colossians using its imagery and vividness to get at what perhaps in a more pastoral kind of discussion we might call social or even spiritual formation. Is that the kind of thing that's going on with all this?
All right, Roy, do you want me to answer that first? To respond to that first?
Why not? Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. So if I stand in front of you, can you see me?
Yes, well,
my
shadow, I see
you. My shadow. I have a lot of power here. Okay.
Yes,
Roy, absolutely. Colossians is not being written with the Roman Empire in its crosshairs. Absolutely not. No, not in no way whatsoever. Colossians is a polemical letter, and it's using and it's casting its listeners in an imperial situation, so as to discourage them from pursuit of the ascetical practices and so on that are described in 2:8 to 2:8 to 15, which is, I think, exactly the point that you're going to be making in a fortnight. And it's absolutely a form of moral formation, absolutely. Yeah, so it is a form of wisdom, right? And intriguingly, another element is, of course, there's a strong wisdom discourse here, especially in the creation language that we find in 1:15-20. All right.
Yeah, thanks. My second question is about the vividness of the death imagery. I guess my question is, how does this vivid image of the death of Jesus actually work? Why is it, or why was it, persuasive? Perhaps among ancient Mediterranean people who, so far as I can tell, saw death and dead bodies as rather repugnant things, as weak, and as you're showing, as well as defeated things. So how do you think the vivid, sort of ekphrastic death imagery actually works in imagery to get this idea across?
Yeah, that is a great question. I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, I think that we get here to not only to how it works kind of anthropologically, but also how it works in terms of atonement language and the victory theory of atonement that we find in Colossians. And I would really, I hope that some of the audience can perhaps help us out here a little bit on this, because it is so strikingly paradoxical. I mean, I think that one answer has to do with the overall imperial configuration of the audience. In other words, that the letter doesn't leave them with death. It doesn't leave them with Christ as bound in a triumphal procession, right? Rather, the triumph is the one that has come about in resurrection, I think, and in glorification, right? So that the resurrection glorification motif are a piece with each other. In other words, it's a single motif. And that the death as a pacification spells the defeat, the paradoxical defeat of the enemy. But where the audience is being brought back into a more of a traditional imperial understanding, more traditional imperial narrative, is in the motif of glorification as triumph and enthronement. The Roman triumph made its way to the temple of the Capitoline Jupiter, where a sacrifice was made. And that would express a kind of an enthronement, a triumph, right, that Jupiter has given the emperor victory, or the general victory before the imperial period. And this then is where the spoils are handed out to the troops and so on, right? So I think at that point we have the more traditional configuration, right? The epistle to the Colossians does not deal with any explicit representations, which is to say evocative representations of the death of Christ. Rather, what the epistle does is it speaks of in New Testament parlance, the Christ event, which is crucifixion and resurrection, right? So that the resurrection part is the enthronement part. A more Johannine theological conceptualization, and I have a Johannine scholar in the corner here, so I have to be careful what I'm about to say here, but it seems to me that crucifixion and glorification in John are much more closely tied, both in John chapter 3, you know, looking upon the serpent elevated, right? So looking upon the glorified Christ, the crucified Christ. There, it's much more jarring. And I think that question is especially apropos there in a much more powerful way than it is here. I think the answer from Colossians' perspective is by the glorification, exaltation language, and enthronement language.
Well, thank you, and thanks very much for letting me listen in and participate in this way.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you so much, Roy.
Thank you so much
for your response.
By all means, let's open this now.
Okay, shall we put Roy
in the room? No, we can just leave him.
Okay.
Let him come in while
all
he
right.
can.
Absolutely, okay. Good, okay.
Huh? Yes, Walter Villian.
I have a question about the imagery of co-enthronement. And you showed us the Gamma Augustea, which is, of course, about the most elite Roman object we
can
see. But it is divided into two tiers, and the two tiers are very clearly distinguished from each other. And although the divinization of Augustus confers universal benefits, that divinization is not shared universally.
Absolutely.
It is, on the contrary, clearly demarcated, and the double registers make a point, very emphatic point about demarcation. And I was wondering whether the imagery of co-enthronement in Colossians, whether you read that also as a kind of inversion of imperial iconography, or whether you read it as something complementary to the way in which the army, say shares in processional triumph. That
right.
is, to what extent is the kind of apotheosis that the emperor experiences, to what extent can it accommodate anyone else's experience, and to what extent is the imagery of co-enthronement in Colossians an inversion of the imperial or complementary to the imperial?
Right. Yeah, thanks. And I'll stand in front of Roy here so you can see me as well in all my glory. That's a great question. So in Ephesians, for example, if we were to ask this question in Ephesians, I think the answer would be a lot clearer, right? Where you have both a co-enthronement and the idea of being the beneficiary of the emperor's spoils, right? In Ephesians 4, we have the author talking about Christ leading captivity captive and then distributing gifts, right? Which is a more of the traditional army kind of victory language. I think that in Colossians, we have a kind of an inadvertent co-regency. What I mean is that the polemical strategy of the letter requires the audience to be a co-regent with Christ in order for the letter to persuade its audience that they should not be subject to principalities and powers because they reign with Christ above the principalities and powers. So it seems to me that this is a byproduct of the polemical strategy rather than a form of inversion of imperial realities. But what's interesting about your question is the Nachleben of Colossians, right? The afterlife of Colossians. Because when we come to somebody like Clement of Alexandria, for example, he exactly takes the model that you're talking about. And he speaks expressly of what we today might call a democratization, right? That it's not just elites who are the beneficiaries. In fact, that we are co-rulers along Christ in baptism, right? He speaks of the eternal springtime of the baptized, that they're always young, always new, and always reigning with Christ together, right? So what he does there is that he takes a very elite motif and I think is consciously deconstructing it and inverting it, right? So I would say that it's inadvertent in Colossians. It seems to me to be more reflected upon in Ephesians and becomes expressly enunciated in later early Christian witnesses.
Yes, Greg.
Where to start? I mean, it's such a rich banquet you've given us. I mean, it's really... this is why our RRA sessions go on for hours, you know, hours around the table, just because it's so rich. I mean, I have so many questions, but one, I mean, let me just start off with one that came at the end of your presentation. I mean, rhetology suggests that, in other words, let's call it logical argumentation, suggests that the rhetorical situation of the letter is addressed in chapter 2, verse 6, and again in chapter 2, verse 16, with, therefore, avoid philosophy, speculation, avoid asceticism, do not touch, etc., etc. And the reason why you should avoid those things, very minimally stated, is the extensive presentation you've given. Here's why you shouldn't, because you've been transferred to the reign of Christ.
Right.
You are no longer in this reign, you are in that reign. That's really the rhetorical situation of the letter. But if the author uses imperial imagery to get to that point, that logical point, and address the rhetorical situation of the letter, why would you say he has to use imperial imagery to do that? He didn't have to.
Right. Right. I didn't mean that he was... he could have constructed a rhetorical situation in many, many different ways had he wanted to. Okay, so he chose this rhetorical situation as and represented it as an imperial situation. Okay, for two reasons. Firstly, it allowed him the logical move to talk about conquering, vanquishing, and co-rulership, right? And secondly, it allowed him to make very evocative universal claims. So you've got to remember here that he is trying to convince people. The whole letter only arises in the first place because he's even convince a group of people not to be doing a bunch of things that he thinks they ought not to be doing, right? So he has to convince them to leave off those behaviors. And a very forceful way to convince them to leave off those behaviors is precisely through these well-worn imperial kinds of narratives, images, and so on, right? Which were all about conquering, all about vanquishing, right? He could have made his argument in different ways, obviously. You know, no rhetorician is required to formulate an argument in only one kind of way. But the effectiveness of this way of formulating the argument, right, was this outcome that we've been talking about. But maybe I'm not understanding your question.
That's fair, because it does get at the question of the audience. I mean, you're presuming what kind of an audience? Because I'm assuming that imperial imagery is going to be received differently by different people. For example, slaves are going to receive this imagery very differently than freemen are going to receive it, presumably, or patrons, potential patrons, in other words, as freemen.
Right.
There's some evidence, is there not, in the letter, that it's not just addressed to a geographical location, but to a particular social strat. In other words,
exactly.
You know, Onesimus is one of you may not simply mean that he's geographically from your region, but that you are slaves that I'm addressing in this letter.
Yeah.
Would that change your reading of the letter in any way? If the situation that's being addressed is the behavior of slaves who might be trying to free themselves or escaping or trying to run away or thieving or whatever it might be, would that be different in its use of imagery than, say, if you were addressing potential patrons for temples or...
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really, really great question. Thank you for that. A couple of things. The first thing is that, of course, I could have spent about another 15 minutes talking about the household rule in the letter to the Colossians, which arranges the church sort of hierarchically, women to obey their husbands to love their wives, right? Children to obey their parents not to frustrate their children, slaves to obey their masters, and masters to treat their slaves justly and equitably. That equitably is a really interesting word, isotetes. So there appears even to be there a kind of a hierarchalization, right? There's mutuality, which is quite different from what we find in other household rules, which I think is unique and important and dramatic, but there is nevertheless the same sort of verticality, hierarchalization, which feeds into this whole imperial kind of imagination. So that's the first point. The second point is, I think I can make three points. The second point then has to do with how iconographically freed people, right, were imitators. So if we look at imperial reliefs, funerary reliefs, for example, we see freed persons representing themselves as kind of social climbers, right? So we might call that, in a Marxist sense, an alienation of consciousness, right? That the very system which makes them what they are is nevertheless the system they ascribe to, so as to boost up their own status, right? But that's a paradox there, and I think that it's just possible that we find that same kind of consciousness exacting itself, enacting itself out here. And the third point then, I think, would drive that second point home all the more forcefully if we take a look at Acts and we see, or Paul's people who he's talking to, which could very well have been freed persons, tradespeople who were freed persons, who were benefiting extraordinarily from the socio-economic forces of the empire, despite the fact that they were still being kept fairly closely to subsistence, they were nevertheless benefiting in their capacity to take trade missions, right? So all that would put our slaves, freed persons, in a rather complicated situation, right? If somebody came along and said, look, this whole system here that you're talking about, this isn't doing very well for you, right? That might have ended up in a different sort of place, but there were no political, university political scientists in the day kind of doing that, right? So.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a very interesting perspective on as an answer to the question.
Yeah. Yes, please, Christopher.
So thanks for this great presentation and sort of building on some of the issues that were just raised there. You know, I'm interested in the way you're talking about this as an imperial situation, and you know, we have a kind of contact zone between something like, you know, a political empire and an emergent spiritual empire. So these right. two modes of being are rubbing up against one another, and there's, you know, you've done a great job of showing some co-optation or appropriation of imperial imagery. You said twice that Paul doesn't have the Roman Empire in his crosshairs. And I'm kind of interested to hear what you would have to say, though, about the one thing that maybe we could make a case is where he does have the Roman Empire in the crosshairs, which is, you know, the text that is on the screen right now that's been the kind of shadow over this whole discussion, which is the discourse of citizenship, right? Right. And the question of Paul, perhaps in some way, as an enfranchised citizen, trying to give voice to some sort of subaltern, perhaps, you know, slaves, perhaps freed slaves, you know, figures that had no voice, right? By recalculating what it means to be a citizen. You know, there is no Gentile or Jew, there is no Scythian, we are creating our own empire. And in this case, I think we can say, in a kind of conscious pushback against Roman notions of what it means to be a citizen, right?
Right.
So is this another element of the kind of hybridity that we see here? How do you think citizenship, as an idea, not so much as an image, but as an idea, plays into to what you're talking about here, this kind of appropriation of Roman imperial imagery, because it seems to me to be the moment in which he inverts it, he pushes back.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for that. Just as a footnote to what you just said there, Dieter Gyorgy in his book on theocracy makes similar points with reference to Romans. Right. That to be children of Abraham means a new kind of socio-political identity over against being a Roman, right? And so that Paul out-universalizes the universalizers, you might say, and places them on a completely different footing. And I think that the argument that you're making is similarly powerful when we think about Philippians, and where Paul in Philippians, written to a center of Roman imperial administration, speaks of the listeners having their citizenship in heaven, mm-hmm. right? And so there is here then a model of citizenry. And modern interpreters, political readers of Paul, like Alain Badiou, right, makes a great deal of this, right, that there is the creation of a universal subject, right, which then has the privileges that are would otherwise not be given them. So you're absolutely here on the right track. The question becomes intention and how conscious, right, Paul is doing this. So if we distinguish Colossians from the earlier Paul, if we say that an eschatology seems to be not pronounced, like a futurist eschatology is not so pronounced in Colossians, right? It's a much more realized eschatology. I think it's a much more a realized eschatology precisely because of the polemical claims that the letter is creating. So if we go back to the earlier Paul, right, where a futurist eschatology really does dominate, right, you have to ask the question, when God's rule is all in all, will there be citizens anymore? Right? It seems to me that there's something about Pauline apocalyptic eschatology that just blows the whole citizenship thing right out of the water. Right? So that would mean then that Paul is say in Philippians, creating an imperial situation precisely because he knows who he's talking to in an imperial civic center, right? When we come to Colossians, it's absolutely the case that no longer barbarian Scythians. Now, for those of you who don't know about Scythians, Scythians was a place outside the Roman Empire around the Black Sea, right? Where the worst possible things you could imagine people doing did, right? Use your imagination. And, you know, so the idea that even they are falling under Christ's rule says that we do this a lot better than anybody else. Our emperor is a bigger emperor than anybody else's emperor, right? But I think that the point here is that the emphasis is not to create a subaltern identity. The emphasis here is to create rather a new moral community. That this is how powerfully moral and ethical we are, that even these people at the zero point of civilization, right, even they are coming on board, right? when we look at other writings, I do think that we have a subaltern emerging. I think that de facto, right, we have a subaltern kind of understanding emerging here, but I don't know that we have one kind of de jure, right? In other words, that it's sort of being orchestrated. Somebody might accuse me at this point of being way too theological and far too apolitical. I can imagine Horsley or especially Segovia saying that to me. But I'm just so nervous about making these kinds of moves that I suppose, you know, discretion is the better part of valor for me on this point. And when we go beyond, giving you a long-winded answer here, I'll stop with the sentence. When we go outside Paul and we look into the early Christianity, say by Tertullian or whatever, Tertullian is absolutely engaging in a subaltern discourse. He says, you know, we do it way better than you, and moreover, you know, you people, you have your elites, but you don't even pay for your temples are empty and so on, look at how full our churches are. He is exactly, I think, using Paul in these kinds of directions. But there he is polemicizing against the empire. So that's a wonderfully expansive question that you asked there. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to speak. I'm not a scholar. I'm a man of the pews. And I want to tell you how much I appreciated what you were doing today and in your paper from the perspective of giving encouragement. I would like to encourage those here who are scholars who may not even like going to church. The value of the sort of work you do potentially and hopefully actually, sorry if that's too positive, for helping to do two things. One, to recognize that while we read texts from our own present context, there are ways to abuse that. And you were exposing what I believe, showing my biases to some extent, abusive notions and overdoing the empire, an attack on empire motif, right, grossly. So if that's being too theological, more power to you. And secondly, by your very careful work, this is a bad metaphor, I suppose, but it reminds me of what Maurice Merleau-Ponty spoke about in terms of the worn coinage of language. That your sort of work can help readers, potentially preachers, to take these coins and look at them differently. But then it also raises a question that you're not intending to address, which is how can biblical truth happen as an event today if all we talk about is language which we don't really understand from 2,000 years ago. I mean, you were so excited and so appreciative of what you were doing today.
Yeah, thank you so much, John. I take that as a real compliment because I've heard that you're a great teacher yourself, so thank you very much. You know, biblical scholars, when it comes to history, are not terribly sophisticated. And I'm not trying to say that I'm a really sophisticated one myself, but I do know that I'm not a historian, and I do know that I'm a bit of an interloper when it comes to history. So the models of history and historical criticism tend to be often rather kind of outmoded, like they're sort of like Model Ts or something like that. They're really lovely to look at, but they're really noisy, and there's a lot better cars out there on the road kind of thing, right? So, in their rush to decry the Bush policy of preemptive strike, there was really a bandwagon that was going on there that said much more about biblical scholars' politics than I think it really necessarily did about Paul, and I think that's regrettable. It's understandable, you know, from their perspective, but I think it is regrettable, and unfortunately, I think the result of that is that the ideas that otherwise would have a lot more currency and value and weight can be really too easily dismissed. And because many of those scholars are still sort of barking up the same tree, changing my metaphor for a moment, I think it means that there's a lot, they're only likely to be heard by the choir that they're preaching to, all right? So, but having said that, I mean, I have enormous respect for them as scholars. The second point about, that's what a text meant, right? What does a text mean? What did a text mean in its own context? But we don't always have the benefit of all of this and so on and so forth. What does a text mean? There's two things to say about that. The first thing is that a biblical text can be understood in manifold ways. Speaking theologically as a Christian, God has been doing just fine, thank you very much, with the Bible without expert theologians around for a couple of thousand years now and longer, right? So that the life of a text takes on its own life and its own meaning in lived communities, right? The value of a biblical study, of course, is that it simply allows another set of tools, another lens for people to use and awaken the imagination in new ways. So the task of persuasion, what's really interesting in the Progymnasmata that I found is that in reading them, I learned a lot about rhetoric myself, about what to do, what not to do, and so on, right? And that the capacity to use evocative language, which in for those of us who go to church always occurs with the illustration, right? The well deployed metaphor. This awakens participation, awakens enthusiasm, emotion, right? And thereby belief, right? So, and what these letters do then is that within their own context, right, what preachers do is that they create new situations with these letters. The letters inform the situation which they find themselves in, and the preacher then uses letters to create new situations, right? They don't have to be the imperial situation. In other words, this doesn't mean that every preacher who reads Colossians, you know, needs to get up there and talk about, and these are the contemporary manifestations of empire today. And that is analogous to the text in this way. And so we learn from the text that, you know, that's a really wooden kind of way of using the Bible. When the Bible has a kind of a power of metaphor that spills way out beyond the limits of what interpretation is.
If I may, I would like to ask a question of a little different angle.
Sure,
here,
absolutely.
I am your interpretation and your this whole approach to the Roman Empire is, and we should sort of openly notice a major shift from emphases for study of the New Testament in the 20th century.
Right, absolutely.
In the 20th century, especially after World War II, the whole large part of the task was to reclaim the Jewish heritage of emerging Christianity.
Right. Right?
Now, a noticeable thing is that neither Colossians nor Ephesians, and I think also Philippians in here, has no specific quotation of any verse from the Hebrew Bible.
Right.
In other words, these texts seem to have moved beyond an environment where it seemed necessary to retrieve specific language from the Hebrew Bible. There's a certain kind of confidence, or there's a certain kind of understanding of oneself or something, that now they're willing maybe to use very specific language from the Roman world in which they live,
right,
to talk about Christ, rather than to use a quotation from Isaiah.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, I have a kind of I don't know how many fold question there
okay.
is in there. It's probably another whole seminar. But I think my first question is, what about those texts which do quote Hebrew Bible things? Acts is certainly one of them.
Right.
All of the Gospels is one of them.
Right, right.
Do you perceive those texts that are specifically reciting words from the Hebrew Bible to be as imperially entangled as Colossians and Ephesians?
Right, thank you, Brian. One bit of the equation that I missed out here is that Paul had two resources for universal language. One was the Roman Empire, and the other one was the Hebrew Bible.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, and specifically Second Isaiah.
Yes.
Right, so it's in the so the Hebrew Bible. Now, what's interesting about Second Isaiah, of course, is that these texts are also composed in an imperial situation.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So the Persian Empire or the Babylonian Empire, right? And so many representations of God, ideals of community, the reach of God, and so on, right? The Lord God goes on an imperial journey from being a tribal God to being a much more universal looking God. He, you know, this God is a God who is as big as the rest of them, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And so there is inherent then in the Hebrew Bible witness this kind of universal acclamations, and of course Paul can go there as well,
yeah.
Right? So, and I think that's really important. And people who do empire studies of the ancient world are doing the same kind of thing that I'm doing with Colossians, and they're using ancient Near Eastern iconography. And the Freiburg School and all those guys,
yeah.
Othmark, they're doing all of that work there. And they're also using post-colonial studies in an analogous kind of way. But they've been at that a lot longer, by about 15 years, than those of us who are now turning to these questions now. We're kind of Johnny-come-latelys here. So that's the first thing. The second thing has to do then with the non-appearance of Hebrew Bible verses in Philippians and Colossians, and the question of a newfound confidence. You know, one has to be a bit careful about that, because Galatians and Romans are heavily invested in Paul relating directly to either people he's opposed to as circumcisers, where you better start quoting the Hebrew Bible because they're already doing it before you did, so you better be able to quote it better than they can, right, with all sorts of clever midrashic readings. Or in Romans, where Paul is trying to show that he doesn't undermine, he doesn't say the law is bad, and he doesn't say you can do anything you want if you're a Christ follower, right? And that, and he doesn't say that God has abrogated God's covenants with Israel, right? That he's saying none of those things, as his detractors accuse him of. So there, again, Paul is in an important spot rhetorically, where he needs to show that all that he's talking about is consistent with what we discover in the Hebrew Bible as interpreted through the Christ event. That doesn't appear to be the case at all, though there is the reference to the circumcising dogs in Philippians, right? But the orientation just seems a bit different. And you're right, there is an enormous confidence here. Right, there is a stridency, there is a sense of here is a community that knows its story, right, and is confident about its story. Yeah. But I wouldn't say that, it would just be way too difficult to talk about, which I'm not sure you're arguing, but one might argue, leaving it behind or something like that, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, well, here's an interesting thing, and we need to stop now. But this, when Brigitte Kahl comes, this is an interesting issue, because she has now tackled Galatians, which does have a lot of Hebrew Bible quotations.
Absolutely, right.
And she says that law there really means law and order in the Roman Empire.
She does, yes,
so,
that's right.
So it, even it is thoroughly implicated.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a number of others, like her, have found evidence of the imperial cult in Galatians. I happen to be somebody who disagrees with that, but she does it brilliantly.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that's interesting to know that actually there you do not see the Roman Empire as thoroughly implicated.
No.
I don't. Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Well, it's time for us to close, and thank you so much. And thank you, Roy. Appreciate your participation. Yeah, and thanks to all of you for your.
Thank you so much for listening. Yeah.